All right, everybody, we've got an incredible guest today. Governor Josh Shapiro is here, obviously governor of Pennsylvania. He's got record-setting popularity in Pennsylvania right now, 60% approval, at least. He's a moderate. He's focused on getting done, GSD. He's tough on crime. Ranked number one, according to my notes, on charging Medicaid fraud. He's pro-data center. He's got a nuanced take on Israel. And he's a baller, apparently. Cut to the tape. Got him.
There he is. Oh, my God.
Here's your governor.
Look at those short shorts. Holy cow.
Incredible. Wow. It's the late 80s? Man, based on the VHS tape, this looks like the 80s.
Yeah, that was 1990, I think.
Look at that, playing the point.
There you go.
Very nice. Very nice. All right.
That was back when people shot mid-range jumpers. They don't do that anymore, man. They don't do that. They should.
All threes, yeah. I mean, we have a couple of players, and we were talking before the show started. You're obviously a big Philly fan, and I'm a big Knicks fan, so I will see you at the games. We're on a collision course.
By the way, with all due respect, and I hope we have a good conversation here, I hope to never see you at the games. Because if you're showing up in Philly with all your Knicks crap on, I'm not going to be a happy guy.
Oh, look at a selfie courtside with my friend. Dave, who is one of the co-owners of the team, who's a mutual friend of ours, who I think egged you on a little bit to come on the program here.
He did.
Which I appreciate.
He said, go on all in. They have thoughtful conversations and anxious to have one with you. So thanks for having me.
Yeah. There's so much for us to talk about, but I thought I would start with your track record in Pennsylvania. And the reason I wanted to start there is because there's a bit of a collision course happening right now between you and Gavin. Gavin's got what I would describe as a variable tenure here in California. I left California for Texas because I just thought it was a bit of a disaster. But you're doing great in your state. And that's in the face of New York, my hometown, New Jersey, Boston, like losing a lot of business leaders. And you've been scoring, you know, some big wins. So when you look at your track record, maybe you could just educate the audience on what you've gotten done. And maybe in comparison to what's happening in those other states with other Democratic leaders, because you seem to be maybe the exception to this rule that Democrats aren't getting it done on a business level.
Look, I'm proud of what we've done. I'm not in comparison with Gavin or any other Democratic governor. I'll just talk about what we've done here in Pennsylvania. We are a pro-growth state. We want businesses to come here and grow. I'm proud of the fact that we've created more jobs in all but two states in the entire country. We've cut taxes seven different times to be more competitive, cut taxes for small businesses, also for families trying to afford childcare, for seniors, for working Pennsylvanians. We've taken our permitting process. That's the ticket you need, say, to build your building, right? If you're trying to build something here in Pennsylvania, we were bottom five in the country. I think we're now a national model, easily top five in terms of speed. We've got a money-back guarantee on all of our permits. If we don't get you your permit in time, we'll give your money back. And fun fact, we've issued 40 million permits during my time as governor. We've only had to issue five refunds, meaning only five of those permits were late. We are now the only growing economy in the northeastern part of the United States. At the same time, we're investing in workforce development, especially if you don't have a college degree, tripling funding for VOTEC and apprenticeship programs, and understanding the need to take the workforce we have today and prepare them for jobs here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. I'm proud that we've got an unemployment rate below the national rate consistently over the last 32 months. I think it is really critical that every kid born in Pennsylvania gets a great quality education, that that kid has a safe street to walk down to get to school or wherever else they're going, and that they've got a job in the community that they love. Those, to me, are the core foundational principles. It's what we focus on every single day. Our mantra, as you said at the top, is GSD, get done. Those are the areas where we focus on getting done. And I think we're putting a lot of points on the board every single day that's having a meaningful difference in people's lives.
How are you getting that done? Let's just take the permitting as an example. Why is it so dysfunctional in California? You know, obviously, I'm an investor in technology companies, and we just saw red tape after red tape. Then on housing, it's incredibly hard to build anything. The NIMBYism, you know, if you cast a shadow, nothing can be built. And then housing prices keep going up. And, you know, if you want to hire a nanny or a teacher, Or, you know, if a firefighter moves in, they can't even afford a home in the community that they're servicing. So how did you fix this? And why can't other states not fix it?
I mean, look, I can't speak to how it's done in California. I'll just tell you, in Pennsylvania, the way we start the conversation is by recognizing permits are critically important to economic development and to creating jobs, right? If we, the government, can move at the speed of business, if I can give you as a CEO predictability to know your business is going to be open in 6 months instead of 3 years, right? Because the permit took too long, then you're going to want to invest here. So we sort of start with the important idea that permits matter. Second, when you come into our state government to get your permit, let's just use building a building as an example, right? We want to get to yes. We still want to protect the environment and public health and public safety, and we do that. But we want to get to yes. So our attitude has shifted. Third, we've got to have that money back guarantee, because that money back guarantee holds the bureaucracy accountable. Now, I will tell you that some of this we've done administratively, meaning I've signed executive orders and we've made those changes. But on other things, we've worked with the legislature to pass new laws to speed up our permitting. And it hasn't always been easy. Understand, I'm a Democrat as governor. Yeah. I've got a divided legislature. I was the only governor for a while with a divided legislature. Now there's one other. I've got a Senate led by Republicans by just two seats and a House led by Democrats by just one seat. But this is an area where I've been able to bring Democrats and Republicans together in order to make progress in terms of passing this this permitting reform. And again, proof is in the pudding. What we are seeing is that businesses are coming here and the economy is growing. Let me give you one more example. This may seem really small to you, but it's a big deal, okay? When I talk about a permit, if you want to be a barber in Pennsylvania, you need a permit, or technically it's called a license, but I put it all under
some kind of certificate,
Right. The day I took office, it took 20 days for a barber to get their permit to be able to go out and cut hair. Today, you get it same day. You get it within that day. That may seem silly to you, but understand, I called my barber. I asked him, I said, how many heads do you cut a day? He said about 10 a day at $20 a pop, $200 a day for 20 days. That's real money. That's thousands of dollars that we're putting into that barber's pocket just because we got them their permit more quickly. So I know it may sound nerdy, it may sound wonky, but whether you're building some big building that's going to house hundreds of workers or thousands of people who are living there, or whether you're the local barber that everybody needs to go to get their haircut, this stuff matters. And the quicker you are, the more jobs you create and the more money you put in people's pockets.
It also matters, I think, on a philosophical basis of who is the government working for, themselves and their timelines, or for the people who put them in office. And I think that's the philosophy, just at least watching it happen in New York and California, is the opposite of what you described. There's no sense of urgency, and there's almost a situation where people believe it's intractable, that they can't change it. And so that's, I think, such an important point, is that you actually made it happen.
I think that's a great point. I want to focus on what you just said there. First off, I start the conversation believing that government can be a force for good in people's lives. Second, that we got to figure out a way to get to yes, whether it's building a building or whether it's getting that mom the support she needs for her kid with autism who needs support. We got to figure out a way to get to yes and get them that help. And then you mentioned in your question the way people get, I don't recall if you used the word frustrated, or they feel, you know, that government's sort of holding them back, right? Not sure.
It's oppressive in a way, right?
Yeah.
Just, if you have that experience three or four times, whether it's at the airport or getting your driver's license or getting the haircutting, you know, certificate, like, it's just oppressive over time. You just feel like the government's working against you.
Yeah. And what does that person feel after they try and get their permit? They can't get it. They try and open up their small business. It won't work. They get frustrated. By the way, they get pissed. And then not only are they pissed at that agency or that governor, or they're pissed at, you know, that state government, they also grow, and this is an important point, a little more cynical about government and a little bit more frustrated about the process. And when that happens, I think that that creates more distrust in our system, and it creates more opportunity for, I think, frankly, dark voices on extremes to come in and take advantage of people. I find that you know, if we get it done the right way, if we process things quickly, if we get people to yes, then maybe a byproduct of that is a little bit less cynicism in our system.
Yeah. And the horseshoe theory that you're kind of referencing there, these two extremes just taking over the conversation, that's not what the majority of the country wants. They want to just live in a high-functioning society. I was curious how you look at fraud, waste, fraud, and abuse. My friend Elon, to drop a name, you know, did this Doge thing. It was a little controversial. But I think what we've seen is, hey, 20, 30% of every tax dollar collected is wasted. Some of it's fraud, some of it's just incompetence. It could be anything on that spectrum. And this seems to be the Republican Party's rallying cry to beat the Democrats, going into California and prosecuting people, Michigan, et cetera. You have seemed to have gotten ahead of this. You've been doing this for years. So maybe you could explain your take on fighting fraud, specifically healthcare or in other areas.
Yeah. Look, I think we've got to focus on rooting fraud out of the system. Now, you and I may differ on, hey, should we spend a dollar on that initiative or not? And by the way, those are super healthy differences, and we should argue that out. We should debate that. But where we should have no difference is if someone's stealing that dollar, instead of going to its intended purpose, we should be against that. And I am. Prior to serving as governor and having the privilege of sitting here in this office, serving the good people of Pennsylvania, I was the state's attorney general. And you'll remember back during COVID, there were those PPP loans to help our small businesses and other businesses stay afloat. We'd probably agree, like, good idea, right? We got to keep businesses afloat. But during that time, I went out and prosecuted a whole bunch of people for stealing that PPP money, for not using it for its intended purposes. Here as governor, I've maintained a similar focus through my Office of Inspector General, rooting out fraud, through making sure, by the way, we're not fronting you money when you're going out and providing, say, human services. You have to submit for reimbursements, and you've got to make sure you prove that you did that work. When we find that someone took advantage of the system, we're referring them to prosecutors. I'm proud of the fact that we've had more Medicaid fraud prosecutions in Pennsylvania, I think any other state. Maybe there was one other. We're certainly toward the top of that list. Proud of the fact that we've identified that. We've sent it to prosecutors, and we've addressed it. If we can address it administratively, we do. If not, we understand that those things need to be prosecuted. We should have a zero tolerance policy for that. And we should make sure that if we're going to utilize a hard-earned dollar of a taxpayer for a purpose like providing someone with health care that they need, we got to make sure that that dollar makes its way to that person so they get their health care. And, you know, our folks are working really hard on that in Pennsylvania.
So pro-business, less regulation, lowering taxes, eliminating fraud, and all of this is just getting done in the state. And then, you know, the next piece that in at least my community, people who are creators of businesses, venture capitalists, angel investors, founders, we pay our taxes, pay a lot of taxes, depending on which state you live in. And then there's this movement.
You should be paying more taxes in Pennsylvania, man. Stop paying them elsewhere.
Yeah. You know, we then get struck with this California law, and a lot of my friends have moved to Austin, where I live now. They just said suddenly, hey, we want to seize 5% of whatever you got. You already paid your taxes. You haven't paid capital gains on some of this equity you own in your company. Maybe it's paper wealth. Maybe it's your company went public now and you could sell some of it, but you might crater the stock if you do. And Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and California all trying to seize assets. And this has really hit the business creators in a really offensive way, to the point at which they're moving. California lost Sergey, Travis from Uber, just fleeing en masse in the last 12 months. Do you believe in these wealth taxes? And do you believe in seizing people's assets on gains they've never received? It seems to be getting momentum.
I mean, I'll just say we've cut taxes 7 times in Pennsylvania. We've got one of the lowest income taxes in the entire country. That's why I'm joking with you. You should come to Pennsylvania and locate here. And look, I mean, that kind of tax that you're describing is not something we have here. It's certainly not something on my agenda. I do think people need to pay their fair share. I think you'd agree with that.
Sure.
We need to make sure that we are easing the burden on those who are working and who are at the lowest you know, sort of economic point on the scale. And we got to make sure that folks at the top are paying their fair share in order to sustain our society. And I think we've struck a really good balance here in Pennsylvania. And I think our growth numbers bear that out. I think seeing more people coming to this state bears that out. And I think there's an important stat. One of the things you cited in those entrepreneurs as you were going through your question is, you know, these are people who kind of started with a dream, with an idea that, you know, someone might have looked at and said, geez, I don't know about that. But they stuck with it and they built up their companies. We see here in Pennsylvania, particularly when it comes to life sciences, right? We're seeing people plant a flag here in Pennsylvania, start with an idea that others might think, boy, I don't know about that. But then because of our tax environment in Pennsylvania, because of our pro-growth approach in Pennsylvania, we're seeing more of those small businesses, more of those small companies, especially in life sciences, survive that sort of valley where a lot of those companies yes. go out of business and sustain themselves here. Because again, I think we're showing that we're pro-growth. We've got a smart tax environment for them. And by the way, after we invest in them, after we give them a shot, and after they do well, we expect them to pay their fair share back to the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And I think that's the approach we've taken, and it's working.
Yeah. And so if you're not in favor of a wealth tax, what would you do to deal with maybe this disparity in wealth that we're seeing? There was just some statistics that came out the other day. I'm sure you saw them. The upper middle class has just been surging. Middle class going down a bit, and people in the lower rungs going down as well. So people may feel like they're not making enough money, but in reality, what's happening is people feel other people have made a tremendous amount of money, which is true because of equity holdings are growing much better than salaries ever will. And only 40%, only 50% of the country really participates in a meaningful way in equities. The other 40, 50% don't have any exposure to that. So how would you deal with somebody making, you know, $100 billion, $500 billion, $1 trillion and never selling their equity? Or maybe not selling it for 20 years. How do you think about that?
Let me make sort of 3 points, a Pennsylvania point and a couple broader points. One, you cannot have a national economy that works if it's only working for the 1%. And you pointed out in your question the wage disparity and the disparity of income. You have to make sure that there is opportunity for those at all different income levels. And look, as we sit here today, if you're making $1 million, versus $50,000, make $1 million, you're going to be able to buy some stuff that someone at $50,000 can't buy, right? We sort of understand that, but you got to have opportunity and you've got to have a level playing field and you got to have a fair shot and you got to have a tax system that works in a fair way. So that's sort of point one. Point two is here in Pennsylvania, we've tried to address some of that economic disparity by passing the first ever working Pennsylvanians tax credit, sort of a state-side earned income tax credit. So what we're saying is if you're working, if you're going out and busting your hump, we're going to put some money back in your pocket. About 940,000, almost 1 million Pennsylvanians are going to qualify for a little over $800 back in their pockets. So that's going to help not only today with rising costs due to a lot of these federal policies, but it's going to put money back in people's pockets, allow them to make, you know, the investments they need to make in their everyday lives. Here's the third point. What I would not do, because you asked what I would do, what I would not do is what President Trump did at the federal level with an aid and assist from a whole bunch of sycophants in Congress by passing that budget bill or the beautiful budget bill or whatever the hell they call it. In effect, what they did was they gave a tax cut for those who simply do not need it, right? And by the way, you know, in the Palace of Truth and Justice, you talk to those folks. They know that they didn't need that tax cut. And what happens as a result of that is I've got 500,000 Pennsylvanians who are going to lose their health care. I've got 120,000 who have already lost their health care. About another 320,000 or so we're likely to lose Medicaid next year. I've got 26 rural hospitals that are likely to shutter because these are rural hospitals that are working at an operating deficit, and they're relying so much on Medicaid, which has been slashed by the federal government. So the idea that Donald Trump thought it was smart economic policy to give a tax cut to those who don't need it and pay for it with those who are struggling and create even greater economic disparities, That is going to hold back our entire economy. Just take those 500,000 people who aren't going to have health care. You're paying for that. And I'm paying for that with our private insurance. So what Donald Trump has done is shifted that burden onto those who are struggling, making it harder for them, adding additional cost to the middle class. And I think that that is that lacks, frankly, it's just dumb economic policy. And I think it's going to set us back.
Here we are. Politics is on the table. Incredible track record you have. But let's dive into the Democratic Party. I'm an independent, but grew up Irish Catholic in Brooklyn. So grew up a Democrat, probably have voted, 60-40 Democrat to Republican, but always for a moderate, somebody who can get stuff done. That's why I find you quite appealing. But let's talk about the Democratic Party and the shellacking they got in the last election. And specifically, what really troubled me, Biden didn't look like he was all there. And I think we've all come to some consensus that he probably should have dropped out earlier. But what was really disheartening to me was that they didn't do the speed run primary. They didn't do, a capsule primary over that July-August period and gave you a shot and other people a shot, Pritzker, Buttigieg, whoever, to compete for the nomination. Was that a huge mistake for the Democratic Party? And when you look back on it, do you think that might have cost you all the election?
Well, look, I mean, I actually wrote about this in the book I recently published where, it became clear to me that, Joe Biden seeking another term was probably not in the best interest of the party or the country. And I spoke to him directly about that and bluntly about that. Once he made the decision to drop out with 100 and whatever days to go, there were not many opportunities, I think, to have the kind of primary process that you're talking about. I think it is important to look forward, right, and not look backwards. And you said in the last election, Democrats took a shellacking. Actually, if you look at 2025, it was the opposite. I mean, the president's party, the Republican Party, got beat in New Jersey, got beat in Virginia, got beat here in Pennsylvania, where we won 3 state Supreme Court seats. So obviously, there's a pendulum in American politics,
sure.
And it's clearly swinging back. I think what's important is that we look forward. And I think it's also really important for our party to have a real debate and to have a real discussion about ideas. What are we for? And what are we willing to fight for? And I realize that process may at times look a little messy. I realize, and I mean this with the utmost respect, it gives folks like you on a podcast or on a show the ability to sort of pick apart, maybe try and, sort of parse words or point one Democrat at another and try and create conflict. But I would just say that overall, having this debate and having these issues be raised and having disagreements, that's healthy for our party. And ultimately, I think our party is poised to take back power, and that will make us better at governing. To me, the whole purpose of running in an election is getting the chance to govern, not just winning the election. Mm-hmm. And so having these debates right now puts us in a better position when we win those elections. And I'm running for re-election right now in Pennsylvania. Going to work my ass off to win another term and earn the support of the people of Pennsylvania again. And I want to continue to deliver, continue to focus on these issues that matter most. And having that debate, I think, is really healthy.
Understand looking forward is most important. But I got to go one more time in the rearview mirror here, which is Kamala Harris was picked because Biden had put out a criteria. Hey, I want to have a woman of color as my vice president. He was very explicit about that. She could be qualified, unqualified, moderately qualified. But then when she went out to pick her VP, everybody was saying, hey, Josh Shapiro should be really in that running. And she didn't pick you specifically because she didn't think she could win with the Jewish vice president.
Yeah. So I got to push back on that. And again, I've been very, very open about
this. Push back
this.
On it. Yeah.
Yeah. And respectfully, I'm not looking to, be argumentative with you, but I was very, very detailed and very specific in my book about this process. And I was very grateful to the vice president for being considered and grateful to her for the candid dialogue we had. And about 48 hours before she picked Tim Walz, I pulled out, made clear that that was not something I was interested in doing. I thought I could serve the good people of Pennsylvania and do my best serving here as governor in a job that I absolutely love. So this wasn't about her not picking me because of my faith. This was about me, in the end, not being interested in that job.
Really? Sincerely, yes, because it did seem like you wanted to be considered for that VP position.
I called Sunday evening after she and I met and had a really candid conversation to inform her that I did not want to be considered. I thought she had some really good people to choose from.
All right, so let's move forward then, looking at winning. You're going to run for governor again. Assume that's going to be a shoe-in. You know, you got to do the work, but it's pretty clear you're going to win.
I appreciate your confidence there, my man.
No, it's clear. But let's talk a little bit about if you were to run for president, which people seem to think you've got a really good shot, but you're below maybe national recognition right now. We're a little bit far behind. Gavin has come out. Hey, I'm running. Here I am. He's obviously in the pole position for now. I want to understand the Democratic Party and how they should proceed, because just like the right seemed to separate and you had this MAGA coalition and you had, you know, the traditional Republicans who were just aghast at Trump and his style and his behavior, et cetera. Now that seems to have fractured again. You have America First, America Only. All the supporters who were supporting Trump now have come out vocally against him because of the war in Iran. And then you have on your side the socialist Democrat movement, which I think a lot of moderates are like, well, that's confusing. We don't want to have more Mondamis. And that doesn't seem super appealing to a lot of moderates. And the moderates are the ones who flipped this election, and the last election, they went with Trump largely, as opposed to going with Kamala. So handicap for me, what has to happen in the Democratic Party to win in 2028?
I understand why you're asking that. I will answer your question. I don't think anyone should be looking past these midterms. And while I appreciate the confidence you have in me and maybe in the broader dynamics here, I think we need to have a national referendum in these midterms on what people see happening in Washington, D.C., the chaos and the corruption that exists there. I think people need to show up in record numbers and vote their concerns. And so I'm not looking past the midterms. I do think it is important that we acknowledge Donald Trump has injected chaos and corruption into everything he touched. And I think it's important for me, for other Democratic leaders in this country, to be able to show what calm, competent governance can actually deliver for people. That's what I'm going to be talking about in these midterms as I seek re-election. I think it is important to paint an alternative picture to the chaos Donald Trump has created, one where you can actually grow the economy. You can make our communities safer. We didn't talk about this yet, but we've hired 2,000 more police officers, invested in community violence prevention, and violent crime is down 12%. Fatal gun violence is down 42% in our Commonwealth. We've invested in public education. And by the way, scores are up. Truancy is down. We're moving up on the list. We're about 10th, according to Consumer Affairs, in the quality of public education. I think we've got to show that there is an alternative to Donald Trump's chaos, to his cruelty, to his corruption. And you're seeing that, I think, certainly in my state. And I think you're seeing it in other states as well. And we need to paint that alternative picture.
So 2026 is certainly going to be a referendum on the first 2 years of this presidency, which was extremely popular for the first 9 months or so. People felt really good about the economy.
Some people.
And that, well, I think his polling was great, but there was this tinge, I think it's pretty accurate to say, the tariffs felt like those were chaotic.
Yeah.
Then you get the ICE situation, that feels very chaotic. Then you go to this war with Iran, and that feels like a peak chaotic moment that we're in here in week six of this. So it's certainly going to be a referendum on Trump. And it feels like all the Democrats have to do is sit back and say, like, look, is this what you want?
Yeah,
gas prices up, inflation. But you're saying they have to paint another picture. Paint that picture for me. What is that picture?
I think on both sides of what you just said, Donald Trump chose to push the tariff button, right?
Yeah.
And as a result, here in Pennsylvania, what we're seeing is coffee prices are up 30%. Beef is up 19%. OJ, orange juice is up 9%. The fertilizers my farmers rely on here in Pennsylvania, up 36%. So we're seeing whether you're a farmer, whether you're, you know, a dad just trying to cook dinner for his kids, whatever the case may be, everything costs more because of the recklessness and the chaotic approach Donald Trump's taking our economy with these tariffs. Obviously, this war has spiked gas prices. up today, about 415, 416 here in Pennsylvania, similar across the country, probably years before those gas prices come down, even if the war, you know, hopefully ends, you know, very, very soon. And so I think it is important, yes, to point that out, the way Donald Trump's policies have hurt the American people, have hurt our farmers, have hurt our small businesses. The point I was making a moment ago is I think that's part of the conversation. The other part of the conversation is, okay, well, what are you doing to make people's lives better?
Yeah, what should the top three things be? Like, if you were running the Democratic Party and everybody got in a room and said, you know what, we really are going to take winning seriously, not get into this, like, purity test for everybody in the party and, you know, everybody's got to be perfect and Joe Rogan's not good enough to go on air with because he's a lifelong Democrat, but he said something about COVID we don't agree with, therefore he's out of the party. Yeah. Elon Musk is a little bit weird on the, well, but the Democrats did. And then, Elon Musk waited hours to, and had Obama at SpaceX. And then all of a sudden he can't come to the White House for the EV summit, the category he created. Like, it's pretty obvious the Democratic Party had some real dysfunction in there in terms of building a bigger tent. And I can tell you, I have never felt more courted in my life than the Republican Party trying to get me to be part of the Trump movement, which I demurred and declined. It wasn't my style.
Right.
But they are trying to build the biggest tent possible. They're like, oh, you agree with 14% of what we do? You're in. Like,
okay.
Yeah. All so right. Walk me through
so let's
what
dissect
the top
that a
things
bit.
Should be. Yeah.
Let's dissect. First off, you attribute a number of things to Democrats that I didn't say. So you're here interviewing me. So let's focus on the things I say. Number two, they went and they courted you. And you demurred. But by the way, even had you not demurred, had you signed up, I don't know that your life would be better off after a year and a half of Trump's policies. What I am for here in Pennsylvania, the ultimate swing state, the toughest state to win in, an incredibly tough state to govern in, particularly with a divided legislature. I'm for investing in public education, giving every child of God an opportunity. I'm for safe communities. And we're building that here and we're reducing crime in all of our communities. I'm for a pro-growth economy where we generate more energy, we generate more jobs, where we create more opportunities, particularly in our rural communities and forgotten communities that have been too often left behind. And here's the fourth thing I'm for. I am for freedom. And I'll tell you what, this president represents a party that used to be known as the Party of Freedom, and now they have turned their backs on that. They want to tell my kids what books they're allowed to read. They want to tell women what medicines they can take and what they can do with their bodies. They want to control the way I raise my child. They want to say, every day that, yeah, you can vote, but we're going to set the rules and try and rig them in a way where you're not going to be successful. They are not the party of freedom. And I think the Democratic Party has an opportunity to be the party of education, safety, economic opportunity, and freedom. That's what we're doing here in Pennsylvania, and that's what I'm going to continue to put forth.
I think it's a great platform. I would add to it housing. The thing I hear about from young people all the time is, I'll never be able to afford a house. The American dream's a bit of a scam, and college is overpriced. So how do you think about housing, and what is that an issue in your state? Or
let's talk about housing. Let's also talk about college, because you raised both of them in your question.
That has disinfected, by the way, just like two generations who are like, you guys tricked us on housing. You told us to be able to get a home and you won't sell your home, boomers. Yeah. And you told us we could always make more than our college education cost. Yeah. And that was a lie too.
Yeah. When I was talking about economic opportunity, it's somewhat shorthand, if you will, for also being able to afford that community. Affording that community can be healthcare, it can be housing, right? But let's talk about housing. Here in Pennsylvania, I've asked the legislature for a $1 billion fund to be able to build more housing in Pennsylvania and repair existing housing. 50% of my housing was built prior to 1950. You can invest a few thousand bucks in a new boiler, a new roof, some new windows, actually keep people in their homes and not have to build new homes. We also have to eliminate, or damn near eliminate, the red tape that exists when it comes to building housing. We got to be able to build this faster. And so I put forth a regulatory reform plan to be able to build more housing. I think that is really, really crucial. Let's talk about college for a minute. The first day I was governor, the first executive order I signed was to do away with the college degree requirement to work for state government. We have 80,000 employees, damn near all. Now you do not have to have a college degree, other than, say, the doctors and lawyers and people like that who sure. require advanced degrees. So now 60% of all of our hires in state government don't have a college degree. We followed up on that by tripling our funding for vo-tech and CTE in our high schools, our dramatically increasing our funding for apprenticeship programs. 62% of my adult population here in Pennsylvania do not have a college degree. So we need to make sure we're investing in them so that they have opportunities. You want to go learn to be a welder? You're going to make six figures working in a shipyard in South Philadelphia. You want to go and you want to work on an HVAC system? You're going to work in some of our most complex life sciences construction jobs, and you're going to make six figures doing that. So for us, we fundamentally believe that you've got many pathways to opportunity here in Pennsylvania. For some, it's going to college. Great. And for others, if you choose not to go to college, that's also great. We're going to make sure that we pave the way for you and give you that opportunity.
Yeah, the Generation Tool Belt movement is well upon us. People are starting to figure out going in debt 100 or 200K versus getting a plumber job, carpenter job, HVAC, whatever, for six figures out of the gate is a much better opportunity.
And, yeah, and to be clear, I'm not shitting on people that go to college. I went to college. I presume you went to go to college. Yep. But for too long, by the way, politicians in both parties define success exclusively around the idea of you having to have a college degree and then set up arbitrary barriers to entry. Hey, if you don't have a college degree, you can't apply here. Well, what about the skills that you developed in the military? What about the skills you developed at a trade school or the skills that you developed working in the private sector? Those skills should matter. And now they do in Pennsylvania. And we're no longer taking an elitist approach that shuts people out just because they don't have a college degree. We're giving them the keys to opportunity, and we're giving them opportunities to pursue more success here in Pennsylvania.
Does the socialist democratic movement worry you, Mondami and the crew? And how do you think about that in terms of the party dynamics?
I mean, remember the question you asked me, I don't know, three or four questions ago about, you said, well, yeah, I only agree with 14% of what you agree with, yeah, yeah. you know, come join the party. Look, my view is that we got to have a big tent. And my view is that we've got to have a real debate around different ideas. And just because I might not agree with you on these three things, I might agree with you on something else. Listen, yeah. I'm sitting behind my desk here in the governor's office. This is where I negotiate bills and budgets and other things. If I threw everybody out of my office that I didn't agree with 100% of the time, we'd never get anything done. When I sit down across the table from a Republican lawmaker, say, what are the 10 things you want to accomplish? I tell him the 10 things I want to accomplish. And you know what? We're not going to agree on all 10, but if we agree on three or four, I'd rather focus on those three or four things where we can find common ground than the five, six, seven things where we're just going to disagree. And so I think if you want to make progress, you got to figure out how to create, you know, majorities, whether it's a majority in the legislature to get a bill to my desk, a majority come election time to win an election. You got to find ways to bring people together and find common ground and not just focus exclusively on our differences.
What's your take on what's going on in Congress, Senate, in terms of Trump and getting alignment there? Because, hey, when you go to war or you do tariffs, this was something we had a consultation between these different branches of our government. And we had other presidents on the Democrat side, et cetera, you know, say, hey, we're going to just get rid of student loan. I'm doing an executive order. I'm curious your take on the balance of our different branches of government and the lack of collaboration, because this is particularly disturbing. We're both Gen Xers. We grew up watching the Democrats and the Republicans argue, but then they all got together, had lunch, and they negotiated. Where is that esprit de corps of everybody rowing in the same direction for all Americans versus this toxic, you know, we're just going to block each other and do character assassination at every single turn. It's the most polarized of our lifetimes for sure.
I actually think the Congress of the United States, the leadership there, I mean, they are frankly kind of sad, pathetic people. And let me explain why, right? You
Please.
Put, what's his name, Johnson in as speaker, and he's effectively a rubber stamp for anything Donald Trump wants. And by the way, whether you agree with Trump or not, I think you can agree that you'd like your member of Congress to at least meet the burdens that they have on them in the Constitution of the United States, which is to be a check, which is to be a separate branch of government and a branch of government that has meaningful responsibilities here. When the Congress of the United States walks away from their responsibilities, whether on tariffs or whether on declaring war, and ultimately just kind of empower the president, again, agree or disagree, obviously I have profound disagreements from the president on those things, then what you've really done is you've limited the power of the Congress. And what you've really done is you've seen a whole bunch of people that put Donald Trump before the oath of office they take to the Constitution. And I think that's just pathetic. By the way, why these people work so hard to get to Congress, to move up in leadership, to do all the things they got to do, and then give away their power to Donald Trump, that's pathetic. And it's weak. Yeah. And I think our country is suffering as a result of it. Look, I'm here in Pennsylvania, where it all began 250 years ago. And the brilliance of our founders was that they left so much of the work to the next generation and the generation after that to pick up the baton and continue to perfect our union. Our founders, though, always contemplated two things. One, that there would be honorable people in office. And two, that the people in office would exercise their power and be a check on one another. And in some cases, slow things down to make sure that bad things didn't occur, bad things couldn't get through the process. I think what Americans are confronting now is a realization that we don't really have all honorable people in positions of authority in the federal government. And that that checks and balance system that was constructed here in Pennsylvania is not standing the test of time, because you've got these profoundly and pathetically weak people like Johnson and others who just simply give away their power to folks who are corrupt and to folks who are not acting in an honorable way.
You keep bringing up that corruption. Explain to me what corrupt things you know that the Trump administration has done.
I think to me there has been an extraordinary amount of self-dealing. There has been a good bit of family members doing quite well in this environment. I think you're seeing more and more people who have the president's ear, being able to lobby him at his swim club to get a pardon for someone that frankly doesn't deserve a pardon. I mean, I think the list goes on and on and on, but those are some examples that I think the American people see with their own eyes. Taking a billion-dollar jet from the Qataris and thinking there's nothing attached to that, right? I mean, I think that there's just a lot of that that moves so fast that the American people are having a hard time keeping up with it, but there will be a reckoning on this one day.
So on the pardons, I'm strongly agreeing. Feels like the pardon power is super abused. Is there a path to refine that tool? Because it relies on norms, right? And ever since Bill Clinton, did some, friends, and then obviously Biden did his son, and then Trump's doing his, folks. It feels like now this is just a get out of jail card. You come into an administration, and then everybody from Fauci to Hunter Biden, everybody else is just going to get a pardon on the way out. How would you reshape that tool?
Well, let's be clear, and I don't think you're suggesting this, but and I was critical of Joe Biden when he pardoned his son, right? I was critical of him publicly. What we are seeing under Donald Trump, you have to admit, is next level when it comes to the abuse.
It's on the way. It's in the first year. It's not on the last day even. It's like an ongoing tool here. We had CZ, who was a crypto person who got pardoned, and Trump didn't even know who he was.
Right.
He was just like, I heard he's a good guy.
I mean, I will tell you, I sit at this desk here and I sign pardons and clemencies. And I take that responsibility so seriously. And I agonize over these decisions. And I pray that I get these decisions right. And I believe I have. And I'm transparent about why I viewed someone as worthy to get a clemency and also worthy of not getting one, or not worthy, I should say, but also not earning one. And these are tough, tough decisions. It goes back to what I said a moment ago. Our founders, when they vested that kind of authority in an executive, didn't necessarily do something wrong by giving the executive that power, but they were leaning on the assumption that the executive would be honorable, that the executive would do this with morality and real scruples in mind. And I think what we're seeing with the president is if you sidle up to him at his swim club, you donate a certain amount of money maybe, or you have his ear for some other social reason, you can usually get him to give a pardon to someone who's important to you.
Yeah, the pardons definitely are super troubling. How do you deal with the family members and the kids enriching themselves? Obviously, nothing has been done by a court or an investigation into Trump's kids at this point. So we just want to be clear about that. You know, we had Hunter Biden getting a ridiculous $1 million board seat. I've never seen anybody get paid $1 million to be on a board. That was obviously corrupt in some way, or somebody trying to curry favor. Doesn't mean the president Biden was, but it definitely was corruption there. How do you deal with kids of, and this has been going on for a while, these kind of allegations? If we can't rely on honor and norms, is there another proposal here that the kids of, you know, people in office can't make money? Your kids can't make money. If I was running for office, my kids couldn't make money in the free market. How do you, is there any kind of solution you can think of?
I think it is important. You cited Hunter Biden. They went through a legal process. There was an investigation by the Department of Justice. I think there has to be a real look. I say this as a former prosecutor, a real look at some of this stuff and follow the evidence, follow the law. And if charges are warranted, bring them in. By the way, if charges are not warranted, don't bring them. Do not use the rule of law as a tool to go against, you know, political opponents in any way. But I think what you've got to have here are people who are operating with real morality. And you do have to figure out a way to operate within the norms again. I'm unwilling to accept that that is gone. It may be temporarily suspended under Donald Trump, but yep. I'm hopeful that we can find our way back to that. Let me be clear about something else here, that finding our way back to that is a bipartisan exercise. It's going to require Republicans and Democrats and independents all demanding when they go to the ballot box that we want to elevate people who are ethical, people who are honest, people who are focused on doing their jobs with integrity. And then when those people are in office, rewarded with the votes of the public and in these positions of public trust to hold them accountable as well.
And you believe that can happen in a post-Trump world?
I do.
Yeah.
I do.
Yeah. I strongly agree. Hey, it's a year since your home was firebombed by an insane person who was anti-Semitic. Your faith comes up over and over again. I personally think people are a little obsessed with it, but here we are. And the Democratic Party's been split apart as well over this support of Israel issue. You have a very nuanced position. Number one, how are you dealing with that personally, the anti-Semitism, which to me, as somebody who grew up in Brooklyn with lots of Jewish friends and all kinds of different people, just insane to think that Jewish students are being, or any particular group of students being chased by the other students at Columbia University because they're Jewish. And this chaoticness is just heartbreaking. But as a Jewish person and literally experiencing it firsthand, I mean, how are you doing with that?
Yeah, I appreciate it. Look, we should separate this and have two conversations, one about Israel and one about anti-Semitism, because you kind of blurred both in the question. Let's focus first on anti-Semitism. I have been very outspoken about those who are engaging in anti-Semitism, peddling words that are anti-Semitic. And importantly, I've been critical of people on the political left and on the political right. And I think anti-Semitism is a problem in our society. And it is a problem on the left, and it is a problem on the right. And I think it is important that we call it out. We call it out whether we're in an interview, not accusing you by any stretch
of that. Conversation,
Call it out when, you know, on social media. And then we just call it out in our communities, in our daily lives, where we see it. On that, there should be no nuance. We should be able to come together, people who are Jewish, people who are Christian, Muslim, and all agree that hatred, bigotry in any form, directed at a Jew, a Muslim, Christian, anyone, it has no place. And by the way, it makes us all less safe. And so we have to focus on speaking out against that. No nuance on that.
Yeah.
On the issue of Israel and the Middle East and the war in Iran and Gaza, there's a lot of nuance there. I'm happy to answer your questions on that. But I think on the issue of anti-Semitism, we have got to be in a place where we universally condemn it. And I think what you're seeing, from some folks on the right and some folks on the left is they'll only call it out if it's said by a political opponent or someone they disagree with. And I frankly respect people on the right, like Ted Cruz, who have called it out within the Republican Party. I've tried to call it out when it rears its ugly head in my party. It is important that it be universally condemned.
So easy to do. Let's tackle the issue of Israel. And I would say, yeah, every Jewish person, Jewish American person who I know, when I asked them about this issue, obviously, incredible tragedy, October 7th, going and collecting the hostages seems like a reasonable thing to do. I was there for 9/11, you know, seems like a pretty analogous situation. This has to be settled. And the United States went and did what it had to do in Afghanistan and took out Iraq for extra measure. It's a whole other diversion. But 100% of folks say they don't agree with Netanyahu's approach to what happened in Gaza. And then folks feel, a decent number of people, whether it's reality or not, that America is getting dragged into this war with Iran, not under false pretenses, and because Israel is pushing us to do it. So let's take these two issues separately. And I'm just curious in understanding your position on this. Are you part of the Jewish American diaspora that believes, hey, Israel's right to defend itself, but maybe Gaza went too far?
Okay. Well, first off, let me say this. I don't view this issue as a Jewish American, as you said. I view this issue as an American. And I view this issue in a way of trying to understand what is the best thing for America, which to me is having peace and stability in the Middle East. Okay, that's how I approach these issues. It is, and I've been clear and consistent about this long before October 7th, that I think Netanyahu, the leader of Israel, is someone who's been leading Israel down a dangerous and isolated path. I think he has made Israel more isolated in the world community. He has fractured really what used to be a nonpartisan or bipartisan American support for Israel. And I think he has put Israel in a very dangerous place. And of course, he was the leader of Israel who wasn't minding the shop when October 7th happened. So I've been very critical of Netanyahu for years and years and years. I've also, for years, made very clear that I think the America's interest in the region should be for stability and peace, and that it would be my hope that you would have two states living peacefully side by side, Israel and a Palestinian state. Now, I realize that is a long way off, given where we are right now. But it is clear that we need to work toward that, and obviously that Palestinian state cannot be led by Hamas, which is a terrorist organization. And there has to be some structure that is put in place in order to create that. As it relates to the war, which you also asked about in your question, I mean, this was a war of choice. The president never defined the objectives. It is clear he doesn't know how the hell to get out of this. We'll see what he ultimately does with his big threats. You know, we're recording this on the eve of his big threat, using language that was so offensive, you'll excuse my language, that diminished the value of human life. We'll see what he ultimately does. Does he chicken out as he usually does, or does, God forbid, he go through with that? But this was a war of choice. He didn't know why he got into it. He doesn't know how the hell to get out of it. America.
Why did he get into it? Handicap.
America, America's national security interests have not been well served by this. And economically, you've talked about this, economically, we are worse off because of this war. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to speak over you.
No. Well, I mean, listen, I appreciate your candidness, Governor. Why did he do it? If you had to handicap it, or what are you hearing when you talk? Because you have obviously a lot more information than the average American. Why now? Why did we do this now? We had done, you know, the strategic trimming of the hedges, mowing of the lawn, whatever the term is, to get rid of the nuclear progress. That's containment seemed like a perfect strategy. And then all of a sudden we decide we're going to do regime change. This is after Trump promised that he would never get in an intervention like this in the Middle East. This is after we were told by the Republicans, do not vote for a crazy Democrat who will take us to war with Iran. And here we are in month 14 or 13 of the Trump presidency, and he started a war.
Yeah.
His own biggest advocates, from Megyn Kelly to Tucker Carlson and, you know, people on the fringe, Alex Jones, and everybody in the middle, the comedians who supported him, the podcast diaspora or the podcast bros, they're all fleeing the ship. They did not want this. So here we are. Why did he do this? Why now? What is your handicapping of it?
Well, I'll answer that. I will just say it's yet another broken promise to the people who put him in power. He screwed over the farmers who put him in power. He told people he wouldn't slash Medicaid. He cut Medicaid. He told people he'd bring down prices. Prices have skyrocketed because of his tariffs. He's got this long string of broken promises. Now, why did he break this particular promise?
Yes,
now, let's examine the record. First, Rubio went out and said he did it because if we didn't move then, Netanyahu was going to move and was going to force our hand. Then they walked it back. He said 7 or 8 months ago that they destroyed their nuclear capabilities and then came back 7 or 8 months later and said, we had to go in because we had to destroy their nuclear capabilities. I don't know. Then they said it was about regime change. Well, great. I mean, we went from like an 80-something-year-old Ayatollah to a 60-something-year-old Ayatollah who, by all accounts, seems to be far more hardline. I'd hardly call that successful regime change. So to me, it is hard to, I think you've seen, I've been trying to be very forthright in answering your questions.
You're doing great.
I don't know how you answer that question because the president never answered that question. He never sat in the Oval Office and looked the American people in the eye and said, this is why we're going in. And you know what? This isn't semantics. This isn't politics. If you don't know why you're going in, you don't know how the hell to get out. You don't know how to instruct the military, our brave military, including those 13 souls who did not make it home to their families because they went on a mission that the president never defined. And we mourn their loss. We thank our military heroes for what they did. And we thank our military who are out working every day on behalf of our freedom and our safety and our security. But they deserve a commander in chief who would have defined the mission. And if you define the mission, you know how to get out. He never defined the mission. I don't know, ultimately, if he will follow through on his threat. Again, it's, you know, it's Tuesday afternoon. You and I are talking. We'll see, ultimately, what he does here. But to me, this has been a failed and compromised mission from the beginning because he never made clear why he was going in.
Yeah, I know you got to go in a moment. It does seem to me that first explanation, sometimes people, yeah, their first reaction and their first statement is the true statement, just in general. And it does seem like Israel was going to do this, and we joined them, and we didn't need to. And to your point,
no, and
about
America should never, America should never be led around by any other nation. It should always be about America's interests, our national security interests, the interests of expanding freedom and opportunity for the American people. We should never, ever be bullied, as maybe President Trump was, by any other world leader.
Back to the anti-Semitism we're experiencing now. You said, hey, let's address them separately. But I don't think you can separate them if we're getting pulled into this war by another nation and people believe, like you and I do, hey, Netanyahu maybe went a little too far here. That is what's causing the anti-Semitism in this country, don't you think? This relationship with Israel, the state of Israel and Netanyahu,
I think our undying
support for Netanyahu, that's not causing the anti-Semitism here. That's what these young people seem to be saying is we don't want to vote for somebody who supports Netanyahu.
Well, I think you got to be real careful on that.
Okay.
You, the collective, not you individually. I mean, if you're suggesting, say, that Jews are Israel and reflect Israeli policies and support everything Israel does, I mean, that's one of the oldest anti-Semitic tropes out there, this sort of notion of dual loyalty. I think it is fair to vote on the issue of, do we support what Donald Trump is doing relative to Netanyahu? That's fair. But to suggest that somehow it's, you know, because Jews are tied to Israel and that's why we're doing what we're doing here.
Well, you and I can parse this issue, I think, very easily. But young people at Columbia or Harvard, where all this is going on and these, you know, pro-Palestinian protests are going on, they don't seem to be able to make that parse. That seems to be one of the roots of the problem is here that people do put together.
Yeah.
these young people. They could be stupid. They could be misinformed, but they do put together what the state of Israel is doing, and they equate it with Judaism.
And that's why I've tried to be so outspoken on this and making clear that on anti-Semitism, there should be no nuance. And that's a conversation where we should all be able to unite, and that we have to protect a place for nuance when it comes to Mideast policy, when it comes to Israel, when it comes to Iran and anything happening in the Middle East. And we need to give space for those who want to peacefully, and I want to stress peacefully, protest. We want to give space to those who differ from the administration, and frankly, those who support the administration, to be able to go out and to protest peacefully. And that is, I think, an important part of the fabric of our American society. I just think it's important. I try and do this work every day as governors to keep those conversations separate, because when they get blended, that's where I think it gets dangerous. And that's where I think it really crosses a line into something we don't want to see in our society.
And you could be super critical of Israel, and you could love your Jewish neighbors and friends. This is a very simple concept here.
And I think that reflects where I am on many things. I've been super critical of the Israeli government, the Netanyahu government, and I'm someone who loves Israel, someone who has spent time in Israel. I wrote a whole book about, I proposed to my wife there, and how I think the idea of it is important. We've got to figure out ways to keep those two conversations not separate, but blurring the lines in a way that creates some dangers, I think, is something we have to guard against.
Yeah, lots of education, lots of opportunities. Yeah. Josh Shapiro, thank you so much for coming on All In, and we look forward to having you on again, and good luck with your race. Good luck with your 76ers. I will see you in the second round, it looks like.
Next year, or next time I'm on, I'll be wearing a Sixers hoodie.
Okay.
So,
go Knicks. I'll see you courtside, my friend. You go to the games. I'm going!